you can find recorded versions of the lecture online with a URL that I have put on the whiteboard here. So in case you miss one of the lectures or you want to once again listen to my very intelligent comments, then you can do so over here. And if I'm too boring for you, you can also do a fast forward or kind of compress the 90 minutes of boring speech into 60 minutes of exciting chatter by doing this kind of speedy thing over there. So there's a button for that. So that's what you can find over there. In the very beginning of the lecture room is mostly quite crowded, so if you feel overwhelmed by all this overcrowded room, or whether you make a list missing oxygen in some form, then you might in the first few days refer to this one, but I assure you it has been so in every year after the first two lectures we will diminish quite a lot, so I'll do my best for that. Won't be so bad. I think it's mostly talking about automata and languages that bores people out and creeps you some bit, so that probably is to blame for all that. So what are we facing here? So first of all, let's check whether our prerequisites for the lectures are the way that they should be. So what we need to know about computer science if we want to succeed in constructing our own compilers is, for once, well, we should have knowledge in some computer languages. So for things like that, lectures like Introduction to Computer Science 1 and 2 are the ones to go for, or something equivalent if you had that in your home university. Then there's, of course, the part about automata and languages and all that. And for that, you should probably have had a peek into theoretical computer science. So Theoretische Informatik would be the place to look for. Then, of course, as we're going to translate some high-level language into something more down to bare metal, we will benefit, at least at some part, from parts of the technical computer science stuff. So things about assembly languages apply here. So Technische Informatik would be of benefit. And then, of course, a lot of the tasks that our compiler has to perform are actually pretty standard, so our just basic algorithm stuff should also be present in some way. If not, you're not completely lost, but you might want to look them up in some place. And I try to make kind of an overview on all these algorithms, but, well, we'll see. Maybe you have to look them up a little bit. If you want to have kind of nice side effects of this lecture, then you might also consider taking Virtual Machines, which runs in parallel to this one, which elaborates more on the topic of code generation schemes. And yeah, what we do here is a code generation scheme for unlimited register machines for C-like language. In the Virtual Machines lecture, you will find also C-like language as input, but the code generation scheme for a stack machine. You'll also find code generation for object-oriented code, for functional languages, for logical languages, code generation that applies when you want to generate code for a massive parallel machine, all that kind of thing. So that's what you find in Virtual Machines lecture. Then there's also ways of, well, as you might have already read, the compiler construction here is titled with Compiler Construction 1. The the lecture with which you would continue in the spirit would be the program optimization language. So that can be considered as kind of the part two of compiler construction. So that is read next winter semester, and that directly connects to this one in terms of, well, what you'll do there is you'll work on the intermediate representation that is generated with the software that we're going to talk about here, and you're going to reorganize everything such that the resulting program will run in another desired fashion, like in less time or with less instructions or anything. Then there's also the programming languages lecture, which is about language features that we have left out from this lecture here. So there's things about concurrent programs, there's things about object-oriented programs or other means of structuring your code or modularizing your code. So that's what you find in this, well, very, very generally termed programming languages lecture, but yeah, that's what you find there. Then there's also a lab course that's called the Praktikum Compilerbau or Practical Course Compiler Construction. This runs in the same semester as this one here and is about, in this case, we're doing work on an Eclipse plugin for COBOL language. So yeah, that's practical hands-on work there. Next winter semester we plan to do once again an Eclipse plugin, but in this case on the Eclipse plugin for the CUP compiler construction or CUP parser construction, better to say that. And yeah, there's also work already done in that, but we want to extend the work that's already there. And then there's also seminars in the general area. For example, that's this semester here we have the one about metaprogramming. Next semester we will have the one about innovative programming models and parallelism and all that. So these are ways to deepen your knowledge about compilers. What do we have as materials for that? Well, you've already I've already announced that and you've read that. There's the teleteaching-based lecture recordings from the URL that you've seen there. Then, of course, there will be the slides. So that's what I will give you. You can, of course, also resort to the slides from last year. They don't change too much anymore, so you'll be probably fine with just having the slides from last year if you are someone who likes to do annotations to your own materials, then that's probably the way to go. So navigate just two semesters back in our homepage and you'll find the slides from a year before. Then there's, of course, literature that you can borrow or that you can buy. We've put a literature list online, and the primary source for knowledge for you is probably one specific book, which is this Wilhelm Seidel-Hack's Compiler Design. It's available in German, also in an online version. I've tried to make it accessible to you in the English version also, but I've been told that there's no funds for that in the library, so you have to go there by foot and just take one of the printed printed editions there. So, yeah, it's sad, but there's no way to give you an access to the online version of that. I'm sorry. Yeah, then there's also the tools with which we work. For that purpose, we have the tool for visualization of virtual machines, the VAM, and that is the one that will be applied in the very end of the term. And then there's also tools for generating components of compilers. So we have the tool JFlex and CUP. These are tools to generate certain components of your compiler, namely the scanner and the parser. And as the J in JFlex indicates already, these are tools for the Java world. So you might, if you want to work on these things, you might benefit quite a lot if you know a lot about these, well, the Java world. So, yeah, that's what we're going to use here as tools. Organizing our lecture. Well, you seem to already have passed the first test. You found the lecture room at the right date, so that will be our meeting point. That's Monday from quarter past 2 to quarter to 4. We will have the tutorial session. Well, there's two tutorial sessions, and there's one possibility to go on Monday directly after this one, or on Tuesday at 2. We will start with the tutorial sessions next week. So this week, I presume that there's not enough time to prepare anything from now till 4 for you. So, yeah, we'll start next time with the tutorials. There will be no... Yes, please?
The tutorials, 2 hours or 1.5 hours?
I think they're intended to be 90 minutes, so yeah, it's not the whole time, but I won't give any guarantees. Maybe it will be shorter or long. That depends on the amount of work that we have on the sheets. This time we won't have explicit homework that you will give to us. So these are the tutorials are in principle optional. However, I would strongly recommend to go there, as you can imagine, at some point you'll have to write an exam, and typically the types of questions that you find in the exams are pretty similar in style than the ones that you will be presented in the tutorial. So it's quite a good idea to go there and also to prepare the sheets. Rafaela, who will be your tutorial lady, will prepare the sheets a week in advance so you can have a look at them and prepare them at home. And then at the tutorial, we will go through all these little exercises and be able to ask questions and see how they are solved there, or maybe even solve them together there. I don't exactly know how she organizes the whole process this year. Instead of homeworks, what we will offer you is mini projects. So I've learned from my mistakes from last year that it would be a good idea to prepare the topics of these mini projects beforehand. So I've done so this time. What we will have as mini projects here is implementations of components of compilers or compiler infrastructure. So what we have already is an implementation of a fragment of a compiler that consists of very much of the front-end part. So there's a scanner and parser already there. And what it does is it creates flow graphs. Those of you who have already taken the program optimization course last semester will maybe find this implementation a little bit similar to what they had in their mini projects. And, well, it's the same. And what I want to have for this course here is extensions to this front end. In terms of what is that still missing? Well, what we don't have right now is a memory model that's somehow related to the types that we want to support. So far, there's no notion of how wide a data type actually is and how it has to be laid out in memory. So that's what the memory topic is about. We don't have any typecasts implemented in that thing
so far, so we need to have a group take care of the typecasts in there. Then there's also the part where we have to actually verify that the expressions that we find in the source code are actually somehow type safe. So we need a type verification sub-project. Then there's language features that have been left out so far. So there's features like ellipses, enums, or unions, and all these very important parts of the C language that haven't found their way into the front end so far, and that's for people to implement in there. And then what I finally want to do is I want to do actual code generation from these flow graphs. And for that, we need to somehow fix target, and that's for us the ARM. And in particular, I want to generate code for a Raspberry Pi in, so that you can directly run it on that machine. So these are examples for mini projects so far. There's also, if there's more interest in that, we will generate more topics on the fly in the area of the infrastructure tools. So there might be tasks within the parser generator implementing different ideas of how to perform the syntax analysis. So there's a lot of room still there where you can shine. So these are the mini projects. They will earn you 0.3 bonus for your final grade. We will actually start distributing these projects after we have covered all the front end parts in the lecture. That means as soon as we start with this attributed syntax tree related part, then it's time to assign the projects. So that's when we will start the whole thing without the front end stuff that comes before the attributed syntax trees. I think it's not meaningful to work on the projects anyway. Yeah, apart from that, there's still the exam to talk about. The exam is managed via the TomOnline or Campus tools, so I don't have any influence on the actual date. In the past, that has been an issue because people were always inquiring for the actual date of the exam, but I think this term it's a little bit different. It's already known beforehand, isn't it? At least I was given a preliminary date for that. So it's August. I think 7th August. Okay. So it has been different before, so that's the first time. I don't know whether you have access to that thing, but yeah. Anyway, so I think it will be 7th of August, but that might still change, but I don't have any influence on that. That's the central dispatching of dates, so I don't know. So August 7th is probably the date for that. And it's only one exam. There won't be a repetition exam. So be careful to prepare everything in advance for that. Good. So, I don't know, are there any other questions on organizing the lecture?
What are the group sizes for the project?
I want to give group sizes of 2, so you can select a partner and work on one topic. Okay, good. So what are we gonna do in the lecture? So what you're gonna see here is a lot of fuss about regular expressions and converting them to finite automata. That is the first main topic. You might have general idea of how to do that from your theoretical computer science. However, we're more on the pragmatical side here, and we want to show you an algorithm that's quite convenient in certain properties. So there's, we will do it in a special way here. Then there's general remarks on how to specify and implement the scanners. So it's not just final automata. There's also a little bit around that that we will need to actually come up with a runnable scanner. Then after that, we will continue on with something more advanced in order to get an idea of the syntactical structure of your input. So what we're going to talk about there is context-free grammars and pushdown automata, and the way how to come to pushdown automata from the respective grammars. And for that, we will have certain principles there. There's the top-down syntax analysis and the bottom-up syntax analysis, and these will be different methods of doing syntax analysis, which also have different properties. So we will talk about that. After that, we will switch over to the next part. So here, that's everything that I recommend to do until we can actually start on working on the mini projects. Then we will continue with the attribute systems. So that's a way how to kind of data mine your syntax tree for more advanced queries in there that's related to kind of context-sensitive information. So we will get that with attribute systems. One application for that will be type checking. And the other application will be the code generation. And in our case, we want to have a special scheme of code generation that generates code for register machines. Of course, an unlimited register machine is something which is not so suitable for practical implementation. So what we actually need in the end is some kind of register assignment in order to generate code for practical machines. Then, depending on whether we still have time or not, we might also have a sneak peek into how optimization techniques actually work, but so far no semester has reached that part, so let's see how we fare this time. Anyway, there's still the complete lecture on optimization that's in winter, so yeah, there's sources for knowing about optimization topics. So that's all for now, from my side. Is there any question left?
Is there a meaning in the colors you use?
Yeah. Yeah. It's mainly to differentiate between the lines. That depends on which pill I take before I start. Okay. So, I think it will improve a little bit when I start using these drawing tools for actual illustration purposes. So, just marking the text, there's no semantics attached to the colors so far. It's just to overwhelm you with color and wake you up a little bit. Yeah. Good. So, first of all, a little introduction into what we're actually planning to do here. So, if you were a programmer and write a program, what's the actual thing that you want to achieve? Well, what you do is you provide a program which can be considered as a kind of a template with a few holes where you need to fill in the input. And these two get combined somehow in the interpreter to come to a certain output. So, that's the general idea of writing a program. It's a text with instructions, and there's still holes left, and you fill them in with the input, and all that. So, the the naive way, or well, what comes to your mind first is what you could do with that is you could start to interpret this template, and given also the input, you can just start with generating the output. That's something that comes to mind pretty quickly, and well, that's as it is the naive way. That would also mean that you probably won't do any pre-computations in that case, so you can just start right on with interpreting and generating the output. So there's no startup time, or even just a small startup time for that. Of course, you can imagine that given a certain template, you might also be needing additional information at a certain point within your program. So at some point you will need to go back a little bit or go further a little bit and have a few lookups and try to see what the meaning of that, the things that you found there actually is. So if you do that while trying to find an output for your specific input in at that point, you might have to do quite a lot of additional work. So that's considered the downside of interpreting. Program components have to be analyzed sometimes even multiple times during execution. You have to perform a few lookups and do a few things on the fly. So you need more time for that. So there's the longer runtime in there as the drawback. Then, at least conceptually, there's the idea of what a compiler actually does. It will the idea of the compiler is to take the initial template that you've fed into the system, so which is this program, and try to generate a processed version of that, which tries to already predict certain needs of lookups and already perform these lookups in case that they are already performable, or tries to prepare everything so that these lookups can be done in a fast way. So that that is the idea of the compiler. It will beforehand work on solely the program. There's no input involved so far, and what it will create is an optimized version of your original template, the program, which is then the code. And with that code now, you will then directly give that to the machine, which will combine the input at the appropriate points to the code, and then be able to compute the output in a more efficient way. So it's creating output as well as the interpreter did, but in this case, it's supposed to run faster. So you have two phases. You translate the program in the first phase, and in the second phase, it's the runtime where you execute the machine. So that's what a classical concept of a compiler is. Of course, in recent times, the borderlines between this standard pre-computation based compiler and intelligent runtimes that do a lot of compiling in the background seem to not be as rigid as they had been in the past. So there's a lot of runtime systems or interpreters that use the otherwise idling other cores on your machine for doing background compilation tasks in order to speed up your program in the background while it's already started to interpret the code. So yeah, that's one way of getting benefits of both worlds. So there's no need to run a compiler in advance, although you still get a benefit from the background compiler. So yeah, it's not such a black and white world anymore as it has been in the beginnings. But that's something for specialized lectures, I would say. So considering the compiler, what is the actual things that are achieve within a compiler, well, what we will do is we will have tried to arrange the variables, the slots, which still have to be filled in a more sophisticated way. We will also try to discover and, of course, also implement optimizations on the whole input file. Well, of course, the whole translation process will cost a little time, but we will expect a certain payoff, especially when you run a program either a long time or very often. So, yeah, that's the typical trade-off for compilation. So in the end, if you want to implement a compiler, you will, of course, give it a program code, or it will result in a target code, and the compiler will do several things in there. There will be a phase where the source code will be analyzed, and it will be analyzed for the units of meaning. They will be combined into a certain structure. You will try to data mine the hell out of that until you start generating the target code about that. So there's a phase where you do the analysis and a phase where you do the synthesis. And for now, for the start of the lecture, we will start also with the first part of the compiler, which is the analysis phase. The analysis phase consists of several subcomponents. So first of all, we will start with the program code. So the first thing to do is, well, if you just get a large, basically text file with just characters in there, you will somehow need to cope with that. That's if you start to interpret everything from the start, you will. Or without any pre-processing, you will have a quite hard job. So what we'll do at first is we want to find the units that that have any meaning in these input files. So what we will do there is we will apply a scanner, which will go through the input file, choose a certain character encoding, and then try to combine the particular characters into units of meaning, which are these so-called tokens. So instead of a plain character sequence or character stream, we will now have a so-called token stream. These are classified units of meaning that will be produced with by such a scanner. So after the scanner has done that, we will continue with a so-called parser. The parser is the part of the compiler which takes these units of meanings and tries to connect them in a way that they conform to the structure that is expected to be found in your source code. So the whole thing is called the syntactic analysis, where we try to detect this hierarchical structure and construct a syntax tree out of the token stream. So no stream anymore, but hierarchy in form of a syntax tree. With that, we will then continue to work on the syntax tree with more advanced analysis that will take the syntax tree as input and try to run through all the components of the syntax tree and find certain, for example, definitions that might be interesting at other locations in the syntax tree, and the things that or the type of information that we harvest there is semantic information. So the whole phase is called the semantic analysis, and we'll infer semantic properties of our syntax tree. And what it will do is it will at some points add annotations to the nodes of our syntax tree. So what we will get from that is the annotated syntax tree. So let's start off with the very first component of our compiler. And what it is supposed to be doing is lexical analysis.
What does that mean? Let's repeat once again. We have program code. It's just a sequence of characters. And then we have the scanner component, which will then put out a stream of tokens. For example, like this. We'll have a string, in this case, this x plus 42. That might be some kind of meaningful code. The scanner comes there and finds that as one sequence of characters and tries to find units of meaning. So in this case, well, you already see the example here. What it will find here is that x, y, z might belong together. And there's plus. Plus is always something with different meaning than the other symbols there. And then there's also another thing that it combines, which is just digits. These are also combined some way. And the question is now, what are the rules for combining these things? So there's certain concepts in your source language that determine how you would group characters together. And these character groups are also called token classes. So a token class incorporates several concrete lexical units here, and these are in a particular sequences of characters, and they are classified somehow. So let's have a look at our example here. So typical token classes can be, for example, names. Names are, well, in the context of programming languages, often called identifiers. And an identifier, well, for example, in most cases, an identifier is something that has to do with characters, and it's a combination of characters of some sort. They might be also combined with digits of some sort or special characters, or at least a few of these special characters. So, for example, this x, y, z, or pi, or whatever you might call your variables, that's a typical identifier. Also, in most languages, well, at least the modern ones, the names of classes or of methods, of procedures, of functions, whatever you might have in your language, are also considered to be identifier. So there's rules for identifiers. Maybe they need to start with a letter and then be ended with a white space or something. So that might be a typical rule for an identifier. So the first thing here is probably an identifier. Then there's also the concept of something like a constant. So in most languages, they have a kind of a computational background. So you need to somehow treat numbers there. So for these things, you need also constants. Also, if you do text processing, there's also constants involved. In most cases, some kind of character sequence. So these are also considered to be constants. So this 42 or this pi in numbers here, or this string here, those are considered to be constants. So this thing over here will probably be a constant. Then there's the concept of operators. In some languages, you differentiate between operators and identifiers. In some, you don't. But anyway, in our language, it seems that operators are something different than identifiers. So these things here are, this thing here might be an operator. And you might also have other things like reserved terms. Well, that's something, you know, as keywords, for example, the if or a data type or anything that is composed from the same things as an identifier, but actually is treated differently in the language from a pure identifier. So that's reserved terms or keywords. Okay, good. So yeah, that's examples for token classes. And tokens, there's the classification. So that's the main purpose of this first phase of the compiler. You take character sequences and produce sequences of these tokens, which is the character sequence that is associated with the token together with its classification. So that's what's produced from the whole thing. With that, you can do more interesting stuff. Well, you can even use something like a scanner without anything else from the compiler framework. What might be interesting? Well, in context of compiling, for example, you would probably strip away all the white spaces and the comments because, well, they don't actually mean anything in most of the programming languages. You might also filter the token streams for things like pragmas, which might not mean something to your original source language. You might also pass them along to some other instance. For example, you have in the C-like languages, you have these OpenMP pragmas, for example, which are kind of additional instructions that do not directly fit into the format of your source language. However, you still want to do something meaningful of that, so you filter them then at certain levels of your front end and hand them over to your, for example, in this case, this parallelization framework, this OpenMP thing. So that's, for example, something where you would filter out certain tokens from the whole thing. You might also wish to already do some pre-processing in the form of, for example, replacing certain tokens. For example, what the Java framework does is if it... That was bound to happen in all of my lectures. I'm sorry. So, constants, for example. In the Java framework, there's the thing that if the compiler finds these ticks there, it will interpret the thing as a string constant, and you won't find the string constant anymore directly in the produced intermediate representation or even the end version, at least not in the on the positions where they have been used in the source file. But instead, you will find some references to the constant pool there. So there's certain replacement already going on there. You could build up your constant pool already on the lexical level and replace your constants with certain indices into your constant pool. Also, for example, you might not want to continue with the plain names that have been given by the programmer, but instead you would like to compute with shorter representations of them, for which you would probably start building up a symbol table, or you might even replace them with something that from which you can retrieve even more information. For example, in the C family of languages, most of the frameworks will internally convert the plain text names that you give to identifiers into something that has already encoded the return type and type of the parameters into the name. And yeah, that's something that's called name mangling. You might want to look that up if you're interested in that. So yeah, there's a lot of things already possible to do on that level. Yeah, there's also other uses for things like scanners. I don't know if anyone has an idea what you would like to do with something like a classified token stream. Any ideas what you would like to do with that? If not for computational value, maybe for aesthetic value. In what context, for example?
If you replace all the values, say, okay, integer constant and character constant, there's an operation between what will be the result. And
yeah, but you would have to consider already the sequence of certain things from that. Yeah, in that context, you would kind of manually create these context-aware components around the whole thing. But yeah, of course, that would be a thing to do. But I was thinking a more simple level. For example, Yeah, that's already going in the direction that I was thinking about. You have something particular in mind? But IDE features that was what I already had in mind. Yeah. Okay. So, for example, if you want to have pleasant display of your code, you might want to color certain classes of tokens already. For example, you could provide colors to all the data type keywords. You could provide colors to all the constants that you found. And without a lot of work, with just this one component, you can already solve a lot of these ugly black and white only files into something more colorful and bright and pleasing. And there's also if you do a little bit a few things like you've proposed, you could probably also try to count opening brackets, for example, and try to also come up with the appropriate indenting of your codes if you just add that counter, for example. So yeah, already with just these things you can do quite a lot. So by the way, that's also one of the causes why a lot of the plugins that you find for Eclipse that have not did not have a lot of progress so far already have this syntax coloring implemented, because it's so easy to implement something like this syntax coloring with just having the scanner for a certain language. So yeah, that's one of the reasons. There's also people in software quality areas, I think, where they just use scanners to or scanner-based tools to create certain measurements. I'm actually not really from that area, so I can't really tell about that. But I have met people who have done a lot of code analysis with just scanner support only. So yeah, that might be of use for these people also. So anyway, we've been talking about this sieving component, which removes or filters a lot of the tokens already from your token stream. In practice, the differentiation between scanner and siever is so minuscule that in most projects you won't even find different components for that, but they are just integrated into the same thing. So scanner and siever are in most cases integrated into one. So the next thing I want to talk about is, well, you can imagine that that finding these units of meaning, these tokens in just a character stream, is something quite tedious to do. And I'm sure that a lot of people here in the room would succeed in when I gave you the task of, please write a component for my compiler that reads a character stream and and gives a sequence of tokens. So I'm sure that you'll be capable of that, but you will be bored in, I would say, 10 minutes or so. And even though you still have to program a lot in order to get the whole system running. So that's a tedious task, and it's full of repetitions and full of if-then-else, even nested to a certain degree. And yeah, it's just a mess to do that by hand. So if something is easy to do and just a lot of typing, then maybe you don't want to do that by hand, but instead want to give that task to some either other guy or a generator. So the case that's interesting for us from the academic view is, of course, the generator and not the poor other guy. So generating a scanner from something more high level is the thing that we want to talk about here. So we need some kind of specification and a component that takes the specification and generates our desired scanner code from that. So for our purposes, we have already talked a little bit about how typical tokens look like. There have been ideas like, well, they always start with a letter and then can have arbitrary things until you find a white space or something. And of course, you won't give your specification of token classes in the kind of natural language, but instead you will choose something more down to earth. And that will be, for our cases, things that you find here. So that's, well, I could ask for that, but I'm, of course, aware that the answer is already standing here. So that's regular expressions. Who in the room hasn't already used a regular expression so far? Or met? Well, yeah. Okay, so I assume that all of you know what regular expressions actually are. So that's what specifications of token classes look like. For each token class, you can specify a regular expression that describes all the character sequences that are considered considered part of this class. So yeah, that's what we use for specification, regular expressions. However, such a regular expression is something that is not really suitable for direct use in a scanner because, well, you need something that that's more similar to an actual machine. So we need something different for that. And as you probably all know from your theoretical computer science lectures, the things that are quite closely related to regular expressions, of course, are finite automata. So that's why they are here. And the finite automata will be the things that we our generator will be giving out as a result for the whole thing. So, first of all, let's have a look at what regular expressions actually are, so that we are at a common base. So, regular expressions are talking about characters from some finite alphabet sigma here. So, we are talking about finite alphabet where we take our characters from, and the program code will be composed from characters out of that alphabet. Then the language that we want to express with the our token classes can be expressed with expressions that are composed of somehow these characters in a certain way, and these are called the regular expressions. And the definition of what a regular expression actually consists of, I take from Stephen Kleene. And what he says is that the set of regular expressions is considered as, well, you might also want to formulate a regular expression for, well, matching with none of the offered alternatives. For that, you will need the epsilon symbol. So that is for sure one of the components of regular expression itself, also a valid regular expression. So we choose this epsilon as a symbol for that, and it should be somehow disjunct from all the other symbols from our basic alphabet. So this will be part of our large epsilon here. Then, of course, all the characters that come from our initial alphabet will be valid regular expressions. So they'll just match themselves. And, of course, we want to somehow define relations between the regular expressions. For that, we have certain operators. So there's brackets with a bar in the middle, there's brackets with a dot in the middle, and all of them have certain sub-expressions. And these are valid regular expressions if their sub-expressions also have been valid regular expressions. also there's the star operator, and if it is applied to one other sub-expression, then it's also considered to be a valid regular expression. So that's the kind of inductive definition of regular expressions here. So what are typical examples of a regular expression? You'll see examples here. So you can combine these things. Here you have the star in the middle. Then that is a valid sub-expression. You can combine it with this valid sub-expression and get this one. Then you can combine it with the A thing to get this one. So you get the point of the thing. You can nest them in arbitrary ways. For purposes of talking about that, we use different, illustrating them, we use different colors here, but of course that's something which is not strictly necessary. It just is nicer to look at. So we have the characters, the symbols from the apps, from the sigma, which are blue, and then there's the meta symbols that came from the operators for constructing the regular expressions, and they are supposed to be pink. And in order to not overwhelm us with a lot of different symbols there, we try to get rid of a few of them. So we introduce operator precedences like this. So the star binds most, then comes the dot, and then the bar, and we might even omit the dot in there. So yeah, these are things that you might find later on the slides. And then there's also, well, in the real world, there's a few other operators that that you might find in implementations of regular expressions, but most of them are just syntactic sugar. They can be replaced with the ones that we see here. So there's the question mark, which is just equivalent to epsilon and the bar operator, and there's also the plus, which is just a convenient way of writing the dot and the star operator. Okay, there's also in scanner generators or in certain implementations of regular expressions, you will also find things like look ahead operators or something. That's not strictly regular expressions or regular languages anymore, so that's something that I would consider to be in the theory that comes behind. So that's not directly in the regular expressions and regular languages anymore for me, and I will omit that. But it's there in practice, and it has its uses in certain situations where you just can't express something with a pure separation between syntax analysis and lexical analysis. But that's something that we'll see later on, especially if you do these practical mini projects. So far, we've only talked about how these things actually look like. We have not yet come up with an actual meaning for our regular expression, so we still need to talk about that. So for the specification to be of use, somehow we need semantics. And for example, if we write something like this, we need some semantics that gives us the idea that with that we will mean that will exactly mean the sequence ABAB with that. If we write something with a bar here, we want to express that what we mean with that will be the set consists either of A or B, and that might be even more complicated. This might mean something for which we have to resort to the properties in sets over here, so that's even more complicated. So how to come up with the semantics for our regular expressions? Well, we can define that in an inductive way. For expressing semantics of something, we here will use these semantic brackets here. And if we apply that to a regular expression, this will switch the type of the expression from regular expressions to sets of
well, sets of characters. So, yeah, that's what we want to have here. So let's have a look at the details. So if we are interested in the semantics of just having a single character, this would just mean the singular set that just contains exactly that character. That's easy. Then we have the empty the epsilon symbol, which will just mean we have an empty string that we have. That's just a singular set once again. And then there's the more complex things like the star operator, the Kleene star, it's called. And yeah, the definitions that you see here map just the operator on the regular expressions to the operator on the sets of strings. So yeah, that's a little bit too easy. You might probably wonder what these things actually mean. So if you apply the star operator on a language, which is just a set of words, what you mean with that is that the elements the set that is expressed by that is just consisting of concatenations of arbitrarily many words that have been element of the the initial set of words. So, the clean star means that we can just combine each of the elements that we have in the initial language together to create new elements of this thing. So we can combine them in a chain with that. Then what we also have is the simple concatenation of two languages, meaning sets of words. What does that mean? That means that we the resulting set will consist of pairs of words concatenated to each other that where the first part has been a member of language one, and the second part of the word has been member of language two. So that's what the concatenation means. So that's a little bit more restrictive than the clean star. So yeah, that's what these things are. And union, well, I think I don't have to explain union on sets. That should be known. Okay, so just to keep in mind, these are the definitions for the things you find over here. So if you find the OR expression somehow somewhere, you will have a unification of the a union of the two languages here. If you have the dot operator, what you will do is you will exactly concatenate one word of the first language with one word of the second language, and with this one you will have arbitrary combinations of words from these languages. From the language on which the star is applied. Okay. The regular expressions that we will see later on, we will probably not always have them in just the plain notation over here, but we might also consider to work on them in their tree representation. So this will look like this. We will have them in a rank tree where we annotate each of the nodes with certain operations from our regular expression. So this will make the structure more explicit to us, so we don't have to parse them each time that we read them here. The inner nodes will be operator applications, and the leaves will either be the empty regular expression or a particular symbol from the alphabet. Examples for regular expressions. For example, we can have a look at identifiers from Java.
And they are also, well, regular expressions in scanner generators, especially, but maybe also in other contexts, may be defined in a modular way. So you might introduce names for certain regular sub expressions that you might combine afterwards to get a larger regular expression. So for instance, in Java, what you have is you, for example, define what you mean if you say letter. That if you have that in mind, that will keep me from stumbling over these things like certain characters are still thought to be letters and all that. So here we have a specific example for what you might consider as a letter. And you see that also the syntax for specifying these regular expressions, that's something that's taken from a real scanner generator. And yeah, it uses a little bit of syntactic sugar. It's instead of writing the actual, well, not like this. Instead of writing A or B or C and so on, set, what you can do is you can just write the brackets like this and use A to Z. So that's a kind of an abbreviation for the other thing, but it's nothing different. I just don't want to overwhelm you with the syntax for regular expressions by taking that also into account. But that's what practical systems also offer you. So you can consider that to be all the letters from A to Z. There's also the capital letters from A to Z, and then there's also the underscore. And yeah, in principle, it would be the dollar symbol, but practical systems have this concept of escaping special symbols if they are overloaded somehow in their own operators. So in this case, the scanner generator has the dollar symbol also overloaded with other meanings. So what we need to do here is we need to escape it with a backslash over here. So, but that just means dollar symbol. So yeah, that's the syntax here. So with that, we define all the letters from A to Z in their capital and non-capital form, as well as underscore and dollar as being letters. Then there's also digits. You already know the form that they have here with the 0 to 9. And then there's the first application for these abbreviations that we have introduced so far. So let me guide you for reading that. An ID. ID is short for identifier here. I don't write identifier because I will use that in a larger context later on and it will clutter everything. So it's ID here. And the idea consists of a letter. So you abbreviate whole things with curly brackets if you use them as a regular sub-expression. So the identifier starts with a letter and it might be continued with another sub-expression, and in principle there's also the concatenation here, but it's omitted in practice, so you don't have the concatenation here. Then you have the next thing that binds is this clean star, which means you can combine anything that the inner sub-expression will mean to your new concatenated things. So you can concatenate a lot of the things that's, that are inside together. What's inside? Well, inside you find these two guys here. So it's an expression, an OR expression with a bar, and it says that this is joining the letters with the digits. So you might continue an identifier after having the first letter with either another letter or an identifier and repeat that over and over and over. So that's what makes an identifier. So that's what the regular expression is. Of course, not everything is so simple. We also have something like this. Yeah, enjoy. Is it a beer keg? Can I have some? Okay. So maybe for explanations here. We might look at that in two parts. So there's this part, and there's this part here. So for the red part, any idea what that is? Rational, well, yeah. And from a lexical point of view, what is possible to write here? What can I do here? Well, for example, sorry? 3.14, for example. Yeah? It's called Mantissa. Oh, I also used the wrong coloring scheme here. Of course, it should be that way. Yeah, I think there should be, otherwise it would be really mean. And the other part is the Mantissa. Yeah, that, for example, what would that be? Or could that be? Well, it could be nothing, because there's this question mark, of course, so that would be a valid match for the token class. But of course, if you want to have something here, you would need to provide something either small e or large e, so let's do something like this. And then we would have to do something over here. Yeah? Would be, yeah.
And then there must be at least one digit to annotate the magnitude.
Of course. So I could, for example, use just my favorite number, or might also use plus or whatever. So that would be valid to use here. But you're right, you don't have to provide the sign here, so it's perfectly okay to go without. Yes? That depends on your programming language. And yeah, of course, it's on purpose. In some languages, you integrate the leading operator in there. But other languages might consider that as being a unary operator and being in a separate concept. So of course, that needs to be specified in your language. So in this language, it's specified the way that it's not part of your constant. Yeah.
We can't write things like 1e9 for 1 billion even, can
we? We can.
We cannot write 1e9 for 1 billion in this regular expression.
Can we not? We cannot. Yeah, because you need to at least feature the point somewhere. So that's a good remark here. So this thing here is not, you need to be careful when reading that. This means that, of course, you can have arbitrarily many numbers in front and arbitrarily many numbers in the end, but in the middle, the part in the brackets here, you have to provide either of them. And in both cases that you can choose here, you need to provide a number as well as the decimal point. So you can either use something like that or use something like that, but you cannot just provide decimal point and then something like that, or just go like this. You mean why there's no
plus at the digit space?
At the digit.
At the digit in the braces.
Like here?
Here and at the other one. And then just leave out the stars. Wouldn't it be the same thing?
Um, you would still need to, or would want to combine numbers of at both sides of the decimal point. And if you do it like that and leave them away, you would only be able to specify either digits, right or left. Okay, so you see, you can already do a lot of complicated stuff with just the few expressions that we had so far. So these are a few remarks for just the slides. If you don't want to listen to anything like that, yeah, I think we have everything like that. Okay, so that's just the regular expressions. But we also need to look at finite automata. That's a finite automaton. So let's analyze that. We have graphs, and the graphs consist of nodes, edges, and labels. The nodes are the so-called states of a finite automaton. The edges are the transitions of a finite automaton. And the labels are meant to be the characters that are consumed by this automaton whenever the transition is taken from one of the states to the other. Then the symbol that's annotated at the transition, or the label there, determines the input symbol that is to be consumed. So, more formally, what do we have for finite automata? We have several components there that make up an automaton. Of course, we have the set of states. Yay. Someone needs to do a counter, I think. There's the set of states that I take subsets from for for sets that are considered to be input states and sets that I consider as being final states. And the other components are, of course, the transitions, that are the other things that we have seen. So they are kept in a set of transitions delta. And also I have the labels. And for that, I need an alphabet of possible inputs, sigma. Okay, and with these things, I can create automata. Of course, I might, especially when I want something that I can run directly on the machine, I'm always eager to get rid of the N in the abbreviation. So I don't like to have non-determinism in my actual implementation of my algorithm. So for these purposes, we get rid of that and define the deterministic finite automata. What do we need for deterministic automata? We need the relation delta for our transitions to be a function, so that for each state and symbol, I have only one associated other target state, and the amount of initial states should be restricted to just one initial state. Otherwise, I might run into misunderstandings there. So for that would be the conditions for the deterministic finite automaton. Apart from just the formal things of finite automata, we once again need to talk about what do I actually mean when I set up such a thing. Well, for that, I need to talk about computations of an automaton. And computations are, well, just considered to be paths in the graph that corresponds to that automaton. An accepting computation, that is something that's already quite close to the language that I can express with that. An accepted computation is a computation that starts from an initial state and ends in a finite state. And apart from that, it must be a computation, meaning that it must be a valid path in my automaton, of course. And with that, I can now define what an accepted word is. An accepted word is
the sequence of all the labels that I pass along the computation, meaning the path in the graph that I pass in an accepting computation. So start in an initial state, go along a path of my graph, collect the sequence of all the labels that I pass in that computation, and reach at some point in an initial state. This would be an accepted word of that automaton. Keep that in mind, because we'll use that for a formal specification of what the accepted language for the whole thing actually is. So, first of all, we need to come up with this notion of connecting all the labels of our paths somehow. So for that, we somehow need to collect these sequences somehow, and that's what we do with this transitive closure of the transition function. Transition functions are just small steps in our automaton, and we will step by step increase that until we have a set of all the valid connections of the transitions of our automaton. So that's what we get by, well, we first of all need to start with the empty transitions with just nothing so far happening. And that is something that might be, that we might integrate into our collection with just having the kind of virtual transition from the state to itself without passing anything. So we just take empty strings. Empty strings are happening whenever I don't leave my state. And then I inductively fill my collection of computations by adding computations from the transition. These are these here. We can find them in the transition set. And they are small step transitions. They have just one symbol over there, and they go from one state to another. And the idea is to connect them to computations that I have already collected so far. I can find the ones that I have already collected in my delta prime, and I connect them especially to ones that are talking about the same, in one case the target state, and the other one the source state. But those are the points where they actually connect. And if we find a compatible transition in my delta prime, I will add the concatenated version. Let's just use the same color. So I will add the one starting from the former Q, which was the already present target in the delta prime, so that's the old target point, and now the source from our newly added transition, like this, together with the concatenated labels. So that's how I build up this collection of all the transitions. And yeah, if I have done that as many times as it goes, then I reach my delta prime. This is the set of all these things. Of course, that's something that's potentially unbounded, but it's just for the specification purpose here. And the set of all accepting words of a language, which is actually the thing that we want to have, that's the semantics of my automaton, is defined as being all the words that I can, all the sequences of characters that I can find within my transitive closure of the transitions that have the as
source state from the initial states, and as final state from the as target state of the final states. Okay, and the words that I find from there are meant to be the semantics of my automaton. Yes. The transitive closure.
Yes.
Okay. So, let's probably remove that color here, but leave the rest intact. So, the goal is to take all the blue ones here. That's these are the particular small step things, and connect them arbitrarily often to each other if the parts that you see here green, if they if the target state of one of the small step transitions matches the source state of any of the so far accumulated paths. So I extend the path only in one direction, but it doesn't matter. If I switch them around, that will generate every one of them. So I just put them together with each other, and the resulting thing I put again into my set. So I will grow that set. That delta prime will act as an accumulator of sets. And if you let it run, that will probably never finish, but it will one by one generate all the possible computations that is that good?
I just then understood that with the formal stuff, like what is P, what is X, XW, what is Q?
The blue ones are always labels.
Okay.
Or, well, in that case, where I've accumulated already, it's strings of labels. The brown things are states.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the delta, well, that's just the set that I accumulate. You also had a question.
No.
Was okay?
I just want to propose you maybe drawing a small automaton because it's easier to understand.
Yeah, we could probably just... you still need...
Okay.
Well, it's in this case, well, it's just starting with nothing, which would mean, well, that's just for initializing the set, and then you would first, for example, add this thing here to the whole thing, then you start adding, for example, you find this transition in the set of already existing transitions, you see that, I don't directly mark it because otherwise it would connect, you see that the target point here is the same as the source point from there, so you can connect them and you add this thing because it's the connected version to the accumulator and so forth. Thank you. Any other? Good. So that's what's technically happening here. So that's already giving us semantics for that. So now we're up to converting regular expressions to our automata. Why is that? Well, these automata things can be encoded quite nicely into something that we can directly implement on the machine, because these automata can be just encoded as each state is a number, and the transitions can be just organized as a lookup table, where you just look up the target number from your source number under the entry of your input symbol. So it's a two-dimensional table, and it's just table lookups all the time. So with that, you can implement your deterministic automaton quite easily. So what you want to do is you want to convert this complicated regular expression into this very easy automaton, which is then encoded into a table. So that's what you want to do. That's something that you should probably already know. So that's the construction that's taught in theoretical computer science. Does anyone remember this Thompson's algorithm? Nobody? That was
Of course, yeah, a few of them. Well, what you essentially do is for each of the constructs in your regular expressions, you define a subgraph, which you then connect to form up a new subgraph until you have reached the whole graph that corresponds to the whole expression. I think there's a tutorial exercise on that. However, that is an algorithm which succeeds. It will generate a non-deterministic automaton from a regular expression. However, it has only, that's a bit lax properties. It produces linear number of states for regular expressions of length n, and as we will see later on, the number of states actually do matter in our cases for runtime purposes. So what we will do instead is we don't know for sure who has been first, but I think, in history, people have always, at least in the Western world, have claimed that the Berry and Sethi would be the first ones who have come up with that. In the Eastern parts of the world, people crowned Glushkov as the one who invented the whole thing. I think both of them came up with the appropriate things, but I think Glushkov actually came first already. But I think they didn't know from each other. So don't ask me who was the actual first one. You can use either Glushkov or Berry Sethi approach. It doesn't matter to me so much. Just bearing kudos for both of these groups. So they actually have the same algorithm, and what we get here is that the algorithm produces exactly n plus 1 states without any epsilon transitions from regular expression. And also, why we teach this algorithm here is because it will already introduce you to things that we will use later on quite intensively, which will be equality systems and attribute grammars. So that's a nice training exercise for you. And I see that time has already run out, so I will leave you here, and we will do the Berry-Sethi-Glushkov construction next time. So I hope you had fun here, and I'll see you next time. Have a nice day, and goodbye.